Welcome. This is Stan Lee of Marvel Comics warning you to look around you, your classmates, your friends. You never know which one of them may be a mutant.
This is the Underordered second episode of Xavier's podcast for gifted youngsters, an X-Men podcast with Michael Bailey and J. David Weider. This time around, Michael and David jump into the mutant saga with X-Men number 1 from 1963, in which the Merry Mutants make their grand debut and face off against Magneto for the very first time.
Welcome, one and all, to the second episode of Xavier's podcast for gifted youngsters, an X-Men podcast recorded live at Gray Malkin Lane. My name is Michael Bailey.
And I am J. David Weider.
And this week, folks, we're getting right into it. We're going to be covering the first issue of the X-Men, which you can call the Uncanny X-Men if you want, though it's kind of up in the air whether the Uncanny was supposed to be there from the beginning or not. I always like to think of it as being, you know, like having to be there at the beginning because everything else was like the Amazing Spider-Man, the Mighty Thor. But no, right there on the first cover, the X-Men. Ugliest iteration of the logo, in my opinion. And giving us the synopsis for that is David.
Yes. This actually did not have an official title in the book, but as it's been reprinted, it's just simply titled X-Men. This issue is cover dated September 1963, but actually went on sale July 2nd, 1963. It is written by Stan the Man Lee, penciled by Jack King Kirby, inked by Paul Reinman, lettered by Sam Rosen, edited by Stan Lee. Cover was penciled by Jack Kirby and inked by Saul Brodsky. And the cover to X-Men number 1 shows the team in their stylized yellow and black uniforms rushing to face Magneto, which the cover calls Earth's most powerful supervillain. A blurb lets us know that the book is done in the sensational Fantastic Four style. And the cover has the original X-Men logo that, as Michael pointed out, is pretty awful.
Yeah. It's kind of... It would be the X-Men logo would be so defined later that it's kind of weird looking at this. It's like watching, you know, it's like watching first season episodes of the Hulk during the transformation sequences when they didn't have that sound effect. So that may be a strange way to say that, but I apologize. Go on, sir.
Well, above the logo is the promise of the strangest superheroes of all. A Magneto on the cover is surrounded by a magnetic force field representative by multiple lines, and Cyclops is blasting him. Beast is swinging on a trapeze attached to something unseen. Angel tries to aim a bazooka and fly at the same time, and Iceman throws snowballs, while Marvel Girl, who I'll never get used to calling her that, I'll be honest, Marvel Girl stands in the background and watches while posing, all set on top of a very plain white background. And opening the issue, our tale begins in Westchester County, New York, within the cavernous walls of a private school. And here sits a lone figure, thin, bald, with a blanket over his legs. This, true believers, is Professor Xavier. He broods and thinks in silence for a long while before thinking, "Attention, X-Men. This is Professor Xavier calling. Repeat, this is Professor Xavier calling. You are ordered to appear at once. Class is in session." And with this simple bellowing thought, four individuals adorned in masked black and yellow suits with a letter X in the center of a circle on their belts each arrive to heed Professor Xavier's call. Cyclops, with his visor holding back raw concussion force beams that fire from his eyes. The Angel, with large wings granting him flight. The Beast, with his simian proportions and marvelous agility. And Iceman, frigid fighting master of ice. I guess with that, the name really does say it all. And while Cyclops and Angel make sure the professor is comfortable and reclined, Iceman shows Beast a new trick by freezing Beast's forearm. Angry, the Beast begins to confront Iceman, but both parties are settled down by the Angel. And class begins. Professor X asks Cyclops to operate a training machine for the Beast, whose first task is to grab a taut wire by his toes, which the Beast does with ease. And the beast begins to spin around by the wire faster and faster until Professor orders him to execute Maneuver G, in which the beast releases his hold, using the momentum to pass through a hoop, bank off a wall through another smaller opening before ricocheting off two more walls and then landing all in under 3 seconds, which Cyclops congratulates him for. Beast has one more task, his balance drill, in which he balances by a single finger on a vertical wire about the size of an antenna as Cyclops begins to release the tension, causing the wire to slacken and bend, and Beast is unable to hold his composure and must leap off the wire before it snaps back. And Professor Xavier tells Angel that it is his turn, and that Angel dare not make a mistake. Angel responds that mistakes are for Homo sapiens. Angel is put through an obstacle course all his own. After dodging a flame jet and maneuvering through a pair of crushing rams, he is able to fly through a fan-like spanner before being hit with sound concussion. Kind of like in episode 2 of Star Wars. Angel is able to recover himself after a few moments of flailing and returns to his teammates. Iceman is up next and uses his 5 minutes of free play to make himself look like a snowman when the professor decides to test his reflexes by having Beast hurl a bowling ball at him. Iceman makes an ice construct and sends the ball back towards Beast, who manages to catch it with ease. Cyclops derides his teammates for clowning around and almost hitting the professor with the bowling ball, as Professor X telepathically tells him to use his power on Beast and Iceman. Beast is taken by surprise as the concussion force of Cyclops' power embeds him into a wall, and Iceman manages to stave off a blast by generating an ice block around himself. Cyclops opens his visor wider, which Iceman claims isn't fair, and Cyclops explains that for the career that they are training for, there is no such thing as fair. Iceman's defense crumbles, and the frosty hero is knocked to the ground. Professor X, however, turns the tables on Cyclops and orders the other students to attempt to subdue their teammate. And the students wrestle each other for a few minutes before Professor X calls for a full stop, as they have other matters to attend to. At that moment, the professor explains a taxi is approaching the main gate of the school with a new pupil, a most attractive young lady. The students rush to the window and confirm that the red-headed girl exiting the cab is, and I quote, a real living doll. The X-Men go and change into street clothes so they don't scare the girl when she first sees them, and Jean Grey enters the X-Mansion. After Professor X introduces himself, Jean tells him that the invitation was so strange, it ordered her to tell nobody but her parents that she was coming to the school, and then Jean asks what kind of school she has entered. Professor X calls out Jean and tells her she already suspects, as he can read her mind and he knows about her hidden talent. Jean is a mutant and possesses an extra power, which ordinary humans don't. The extra power is how the professor came up with the name for his students, the X-Men. As if on cue, the X-Men re-enter the study, decked out in civilian clothes, and Professor X introduces them with their real names, alongside their X-Men code names. Hank McCoy, the Beast, Bobby Drake, Iceman, Slim Summers, Cyclops, and Warren Worthington, the Angel. And in turn, Professor X introduces Jean Grey, who will be called Marvel Girl. Hank asks why she is being called Marvel Girl and what power she has, as Warren lays some cheesy lines on her. Slim offers a chair for Jean, but she assures him that she has this under control, and the chair scoots across the room all on its own. This freaks the X-Men out, and Professor X urges Jean to demonstrate her power more. With her mind, Jean takes a book off of a shelf, leafs through it, and places it back without lifting a finger. Professor X explains that his power of telepathy and how it made normal humans distrust him. The human race is not ready to accept those with extra powers, and so Professor X made the school as a safe haven to train mutants to use their power to help mankind. The professor further explains that a childhood accident took the use of his legs, but through his control panel, he is in control of many devices and never out of touch with his X-Men. Professor X leaves the students to get to know each other better, which Hank apparently mistakes as an invitation to date rape Jean as he tries to lay a kiss on her.
I don't know if it was that bad.
It was pretty forward, especially, well, as we get to know the character later on, it's it's off. It's way off.
Yes, definitely.
But if, Jean uses her power to throw Hank into the air and spin him around and drop him on a sofa, proving that a rape whistle is not necessary. And Jean wonders if she was too rough on the Beast, and Professor X assures her that for their mission, the training has to be rough. So Jean asks for clarification of the mission, and Professor X speaks of evil mutants who do not want to help mankind but destroy it, and the X-Men exist to combat those evil mutants. Which, by some coincidence, switches us to another scene in a secret laboratory near Cape Citadel, where Magneto monologues to himself about how the human race no longer deserves dominion over the Earth, and he plans on bringing them to their knees to bow before Homo Superior. Magneto displays his power over the magnetic forces of the Earth by sabotaging the launch of the world's most powerful rocket and crashing it to the ground. The humans working at Cape Citadel are befuddled. That's a word nobody uses enough anymore.
I agree.
Yep. It appears the rocket was tampered with, but how could anything get through their maximum security measures? The next day, news spreads quickly that the test failed, and this would be the sixth in a series of failed tests. Worse yet, back at the launching site, a machine gun comes to life and begins firing on the troops guarding the place. Then a tank also begins running amok, and a general tells his troops to sound the alarm, condition red, when a message appears in the sky made out of magnetized dust particles in the air. And the message reads, "Surrender the base or I'll take it by force," and it's signed Magneto. Yes, I also thought of the Surrender Dorothy. And noticing that the troops are startled, Magneto uses the opportunity to direct his magnetic energy into a device that increases his power and launch one of the base's missiles. And luckily, the missile harmlessly lands at sea, but the general demands that the troops find this Magneto. And as if invited, Magneto walks right up to the gate in his scarlet costume, purple cape, and domed helmet. He disarms the military police by making their guns too heavy to lift, and then switches his energies to repel anything that comes near him, making him literally untouchable. Magneto is able to corral all the troops and trap them in an energy dome until the general arrives, demanding an explanation. Magneto explains quite clearly that he claims the installation of the name in the name of Homo Superior. And the general is unable to act as he and the rest of his troops are trapped inside Magneto's magnetic field. Back at Xavier's school, which would be the second day for Jean Grey, she tries on her new X-Men uniform and discovers her own classmates are spying on her. Before an argument can break out, the professor demands the immediate presence of the students. Once assembled, the professor explains out loud that there is a crisis at Cape Citadel and the first evil mutant has made his appearance. And Jean thinks to herself, "I've never seen the professor so fired up before." So the X-Men are to gear up and defeat him. The professor adds that this will be their trial by fire. So Iceman ices up and pulls on his boots, and the Angel takes off the really elaborate harness that folds his wings in and slides on his uniform. And the whole team is driven to the airport in a Rolls Royce with tinted windows and then board a plane that is flown telepathically by Professor Xavier. At Cape Citadel, Cyclops addresses the general and tells him that the X-Men can help if they can be granted just 15 minutes. With nothing to lose, the general gives the X-Men the okay and they spring into action. Cyclops takes point and the professor tells him to use his energy beam. When Cyclops does this, it gives a natural counterforce to the magnetic field, and the field begins to actually bend. So Cyclops turns up the juice to full blast, and the field is open. And at that moment, Magneto feels weakened by the break in his energy and realizes that he is facing an enemy that is superhuman as he is. The X-Men forge on toward Magneto, even with Cyclops nearly knocked out from the strain of using his power at such a level. Magneto fires a whole horde of interceptor missiles at the X-Men, with Angel as the first target. So Angel does his best to outmaneuver them, but finds himself pursued by them no matter what he does. Iceman is actually able to fling ice grenades at the missiles, covering their noses and knocking out their guidance systems. All but one, which continues to dog the Angel. Angel leads it to a launching tower, where he's able to pass the missile off to Beast, who catches it with his feet. And then Marvel Girl uses her telekinesis to throw it to sea, where it harmlessly detonates. Not bad for not training together. and Magneto is surprised at the skill of his adversaries, but still contends that he is the master of magnetism, and he will be their master.
Who's the master? I'm the master. Who's the master?
Master Blaster rules Bartertown.
Who rules Bartertown? Master Blaster rules Bartertown.
So the angel spots Magneto and begins to face the villain head on. That Magneto hurls a large metal large metal objects at Warren, which a revived Cyclops blasts to break Angel out of basically a metal cocoon. And Magneto retaliates by igniting a drum of rocket fuel. With no chance to run, Iceman covers the team in an ice igloo as the fuel detonates, creating a huge explosion. Magneto assumes, by the intensity of the explosion, that nobody could have survived. But the X-Men prove him wrong as they burst up from the ground, as Cyclops was able to use his concussion beam to create an underground escape tunnel. Magneto tells the X-Men that they have not defeated him yet, and uses magnetic repulsion to fly away while generating a force field to keep the X-Men on the ground. By the time they free themselves from the field, Magneto is gone, but the base is saved. Returning to the General to give him the all clear, the General remarks that that is uncanny. Their 15 minutes aren't even up, and congratulates the Merry Marvel Mutants. Cyclops thanks the General and tells him that if America's security is ever threatened again, the X-Men will be back. Flying home on their jet, the professor telepathically tells his students that they've done well, and all of the training and sacrifices have been worth it. And that wraps up the newest, most unusual tale in the annals of modern magazines, but the best is yet to come.
Indeed.
And this story was actually reprinted in Marvel Tales Annual No. 2, Amazing Adventures No. 1, and Amazing Adventures No. 2. Marvel Masterworks Volume 3, X-Men number 1 through 10 hardcover, the Marvel Milestone Edition X-Men number 1, and Uncanny X-Men Masterworks.
Yep, the little softcover thing that I mentioned last episode, which I'm actually holding in my hand right now, though I will be switching over to my digital copy in a second just because it's nicer to look at.
Yeah, it's a little
bit. It's got the ads.
Yeah, the ads are great. So why don't you lead us off this week?
Okay, my notes. So right away, looking at the cover, I actually really like this cover, even though I don't like the logo. The picture of Iceman, Marvel Girl, and Cyclops in the upper left-hand corner is really kind of creepy when you look at it. They don't look particularly like superheroes. They look strange, which is great. Though I do have to ask for the cover, why does Angel have a bazooka?
I don't know.
What the hell is going on here?
Well, the bazooka and Beast Trapeze have bothered me since I was a teenager.
The first thing I noticed when I read this back in like 91, 92 when I bought it is in this first issue, the Beast is really treated like a lummox. He is, you know, it's like, Lego my arm, you blasted walking icicle, you want me to freeze to death? And I think in a way it was kind of a thing characterization to put on him.
Oh, very much.
That will change very, very quickly. Iceman, visually, is very much like the thing initially. He's kind of misshapen and undefined, but it still looks cool, and I love the boots. No, seriously,
no, I
love
do.
The whole opening scene is great. It is probably, some people may look at it as clunky today, but this was the introduction to these characters. And instead of, you know, describing the powers and showing them later, Jack draws this danger room sequence, which is freaking amazing. You know, you get to see what these characters can do, you get to see what their powers are, and it opens with a big action piece, which I think you need. That one panel on page 4, though, of Angel fluttering like a hummingbird is really cool. Professor Xavier is so creepy looking. He looks like his arms don't work either. Like, all through the issue.
Now that you point that out, I see that. I mean, they must, because he has a device that controls, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so we know they do. It just, I don't see him using it now that you point that out.
I do like Iceman on page 5 putting on a hat and a carrot nose and button eyes, and I'm sure something on there is made of coal. I'm not quite sure what it is, and the broom, and event, that immediately turns into a training exercise.
Isn't it convenient there was a carrot nearby?
Yeah. Page 6, that middle panel of Cyclops using his visor for the first time is great. It really shows kind of the raw power that he possesses. I really like these costumes, too. Yeah, I'm a really big fan of the black and yellow costumes. More so than I thought I would be, but I really, really dig them. Page 8. Okay. Do we really need the extra power X-Men explanation?
I mean, really? That's Stan Lee basically justifying the title of the book.
On the bottom of that page 8, by the way, I am sure that these threads were styling in the 60s, but Slim Summers in his plaid pants and his yellow shirt just does nothing for me. But yeah, they're pretty much all one to jump on Jean like the moment she walks in, and I'm sure someone's thinking, you know, this has been a huge sausage fest. I'm glad we got a woman in here, and she's very much a Marvel girl of the 60s. She's got a nice hat, she's wearing gloves, and she's got a scarf.
Pretty I know much that sounds... the uniform.
Page 10, I know you have the same thought. The first inconsistency rears its ugly head. Due to a childhood accident, I myself must remain in the chair. Boy, is that retconned all to hell later.
And it doesn't take long either. It's pretty quick.
But you're right. You know, I didn't really notice before, but Hank's really... like, he's got his meaty hands, like, all... like, if Kirby had drawn his face a little differently, he would have been, like, one of the thugs. And looking really really mean, but here it just looks like an oaf.
It's awkward.
It is really bizarre on page 11 at the top in the third panel that when Professor Xavier is explaining about the evil mutants, we have like a picture of the globe and the cosmos behind him.
Which is weird because that's an image that gets reused a lot.
I mean, it doesn't really make much sense here, because everything has been this room. So, but in a couple issues, episodes, I don't know exactly which one we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about something very, very creepy involving Professor Xavier and Jean.
Yeah.
But right there on the top of page 11 in that first panel, that's where it starts. The way he's looking at her makes me very uncomfortable.
Oh, wow. His eyes are like lasers on her.
Magneto's costume was awesome from the beginning. Just absolutely cool. And get used to seeing him in that helmet, because you're not going to ever see him out in all of the issues we're going to be covering before John Byrne takes over as artist of the title.
Yeah, no joke.
You never see it. It was a big secret. I think that's kind of cool, though. The scene with the military base, this is pure Marvel awesomeness from the Silver Age. It has no basis of realism. This is not how a military base would react, but it's how a military base reacts in the Marvel universe. And yeah, surrender Dorothy on page. but even little things like on page 14 of the missile launching at the top, that's... the art in this issue is so great. The storytelling is clear. The action is dynamic. I just have one big problem. Stan, what the hell were you thinking on page 15 of blocking Magneto with a word balloon? Page 15, panel 4. Magneto is almost complete. Like his head and shoulders are covered.
You see it now.
And he's talking, which is the weird part.
So, I totally didn't catch that, but that's pretty. I mean, Basically, it's, from this torso down is all you see.
It's made up for at the bottom of page 15. That last shot of like Magneto up close is like really cool. And you can kind of see the detail work on his helmet.
And it's a really good precursor to when we would see down the road that there would just be a shadow in the helmet and eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Which I always thought was just badass.
He's really accentuating the horns on the top of his helmet as well. Making Magneto kind of look like the devil. Page 16, Marvel Girl, I love you. You're great. Christian Dior would never design that costume.
No.
Not at all. She makes that comment, whoever designed this uniform could give Christian Dior a run for his money. And I guess today it would be like, whoever designed this uniform could give Vera Wang a run for her money. So, but you know what? I never mind in these 60s stories the cultural references of the time. Because these issues live in the time period that they were released in. And they don't have to. To me, I don't need a story that has no references to the time period it's in, because they are what they are and they were groundbreaking at the time, and I kind of respect them. Really, it's kind of a recent development with me, because I used to hate to see all like the, you know, them making comments about, you know, like Steve McQueen or something, but don't mind it anymore. Bottom of page 16, Bobby, I know you're only 16, and that's an interesting thing of that Bobby is the youngest. He's 16. So how old are the rest of them?
18 or 19, because they say they're a couple of years older.
Why didn't you put the boots on and then ice up?
Well, what's he wearing under the ice? What is the professor putting them in?
I don't know. Do we ever? Because eventually he gets his, you know, he gets the underwear.
Yeah.
And then that's iced over. Page 17 has my biggest pet peeve when it comes to the Angel. I don't care how great that harness is. You ain't hiding them wings.
No. Well, I mean, they even reference that later in X-Factor when he had to wear the very gargantuan backpack.
Mm-hmm. It's just like, wow. I really wonder what went through Stan Lee's mind when he got page 17, though, because at the top you have the Angel getting ready, then you have a car, then you have a plane. And the whole he's flying it with his thoughts, that's just weird. But yeah, bottom of that page, Cyclops just shows up. With all due respect, General, I represent the X-Men. Perhaps we can help. Look, we're having trouble with one guy in the cornball costume. Now, who or what are the X-Men? And they just go, okay.
Jump on in there.
You go take care of that. And I guess maybe the thought is, well, if the kids die, it's not a great loss. So, the battle scene, basically, the rest of the issue, is fantastic. There, Kirby is having a ball, obviously, drawing this. The missiles flying all about, Iceman hitting them with, you know, his powers. The bottom of page 20 where Warren flips up and the missile keeps going under him. That looks great. The whole scene where on the next page where the Beast catches one of the missiles with his. I almost called them prehensile feet, but it's actually not a bad description.
No, it's actually accurate.
Page 22, though, that third panel, when did Magneto gain all that weight? Is that Magneto's stunt double pushing the thing of rocket fuel? It's like I expect to see like a big mustache on him.
Just like in Spaceballs?
Yes, exactly. Or in that on the Stewie Griffin movie where he falls out of the window. And it's like an old man in a mustache, and then he comes out of the thing. The only problem, really the only legitimate problem I had with this, is that it just ends. It's like the military shaking hands with the X-Men, and then we have the floating head of Xavier over a plane as they're flying home. And it's just, wow, it's over. I kind of was expecting more of a... Can't we at least have dessert or something?
Yeah.
You know, some cuddle time? You know,
the mega happy ending?
Can we go out to the Waffle House and grab some, you know, scattered, smothered, and cover hash browns? Seriously. No, but I love this issue. I really do. I think as weak as the X-Men is considered with all the other Marvel titles of the time period, this is a great opening issue. It gives you, it tells you everybody's powers. It gives you the villain. It gives you a couple really great action sequences. And it has the Stan Lee characterization. This is almost like it's going to sound insulting, but it's not. It's almost a formulaic Marvel book.
Yeah, and that's not a bad thing at all. Clearly, the Marvel formula works.
Yes.
And rereading it, I mean, I read it for the first time in the Milestone edition back in the early 90s. Rereading it from a much different perspective, I really enjoyed it a lot more than I remembered enjoying it the first time.
The last thing I want to address is the pronunciation, because there's different ways to pronunciate every word. The word Magneto. A lot of people are obsessed with saying Magneto because of magnet. But I remember reading that Stan Lee came up with the name Magneto because of the magneto hydrodynamic drive. And this is a propulsor. It's a method for... I'm on Wikipedia now, so yes, it's going to sound like that. A magneto hydrodynamic drive is a method for propelling seagoing vessels using only electric and magnetic fields with no moving parts. So Magneto comes from magneto hydrodynamics. And that's one to grow on.
Ding, ding, ding. Thanks, Michael J. Fox.
I recently listened to somebody, I think it was in the 70s, actually did like a full cast reading of this issue with sound effects and everything and music. It's really bizarre.
Really?
Yes. It's very, very strange.
Yeah, I wouldn't feel that. I don't see how that would play out, since a lot of this is visual. But that you mentioned, I mean, rereading this, I forgot. I guess I didn't realize at the time, because this would have been early 90s. It was the Jim Lee era and the Rob Liefeld no toes era, no feet era. And, you know, very high intensity violence. I forgot how action packed this actually was.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, Kirby did not do... Kirby had two settings, Cosmic and Go.
So he may have been the original Charlie Sheen.
Except less crazy. No, seriously, love this issue. Really glad I got to reread it. And I really have no real faults with it. I mean, I picked at a few things here and there. And the whole thing with Xavier saying he was, you know, crippled as a child kind of stood out to me. But that's only because I know what comes later. So.
Yeah, that and Jean pointing out she's never seen the professor this fired up before.
Yeah, that bugged me. I didn't say anything because I figured you would. But when I read that, I'm like, really? Yeah, I guess you've never seen him that fired up before, because this is the second day you've seen him.
Or is it?
Dun, dun, dun.
That's a note for later. Earmark that. And, I mean, you know what hit me, though? For all the praise that would come later as far as the X-Men symbolizing racism, tolerance, the Xavier's dream, it really didn't occur here. There was a little speech, but mostly it was a straightforward superhero story.
It's interesting how militaristic Xavier was in this issue.
He was harsh.
He's just like, you guys are going out there, you're going to be fighting, and you better get used to it now, or you're going to die. It's just like, wow.
Well, he's basically running a Fagin operation.
Mm-hmm. I'll agree with that.
And I don't know why it hits me now and not at 14, because maybe at that age I was just, you know, the idea was it'd be awesome to be a superhero, but even to their training, Angel almost gets a wing singed by one of the flames.
Mm-hmm.
He almost gets smashed. Beast almost gets smacked in the face with a wire. Cyclops embeds Beast into a wall, and then they all pile on each other in an awkward wrestling situation where Professor X is watching.
Hey there, muscly arm.
You can't catch me.
You bring me any good news today?
Well, it is. Professor X really is, and we're going to find out more and more, he's a creepy, creepy man.
As long as he never yells, whoever can take the most Tylenol PM wins.
And actually, my wife pointed out, what is he a professor of? Does he actually have degrees? Yes, he does. He has PhDs in genetics, biophysics, and psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he is actually an intellectual.
He's a Renaissance man.
But how does that apply to an intense, as you mentioned, militaristic training program? Where did he get his training to do that?
Good question.
And you notice, and of course, I guess it wouldn't matter at the time if you're reading this first time out as it came out on the stands. Cerebro is absent.
Mm-hmm.
So Professor X is reliant on news bulletins, and there is no actual danger room.
Though in the introduction to that Uncanny X-Men Masterworks softcover I have, Stan Lee talks about this being the danger room and how no one had ever really done anything like that before in comics.
That's true. So it was sort of an early version of the danger room?
Yeah, I'm guessing.
Well, how big do you think this room is? Because Angel's actually able to fly in there, and Iceman is doing some weird pole dance on page one.
I assumed that basically he knocked a floor out of one of the wings of the building, and it's like a gymnasium almost in the school. That's how I've always kind of imagined. I mean, the danger room of the future is going to be awesome with holograms and stuff like that, but here, you know, if you were going to physically do something like this, you would have to do some extensive remodeling of a section of the house to allow Angel to fly as high as he does.
And did you notice on page two, Professor X seems to gain a lot of weight in his cranium?
Yes.
His dome gets huge.
Yes, it does.
But I had the same sort of note you did about the Beast. He really just gets played like a palooka.
Mm-hmm.
Just the brutish, you know, big guy. And clearly, I mean, there's room for these characters to develop, and they do very well. But I'm not seeing the Beast we're going to know in the Beast we're seeing here.
Yeah, I mean, they're still working the kinks out, and that's another thing about Silver Age Marvel is, while, you know, we'll point out inconsistencies, he was making this stuff up as he went along.
Yeah.
So you really can't be too hard on him.
So he's basically using the George Lucas method.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. No, really, Stan Lee had everything worked out. He knew that Xavier was going to turn out to be Scott Summers' father from the beginning.
Well, what really cracks me up even more is Angel Warren ends up breaking up the fight and being the level-headed one.
Yeah, he's the one not hitting on her, and later he'll be a ladies' man.
Hello there.
Touch that belly. See how hard it is.
Can I take you out and buy you a fifth sandwich?
I want to buy you a fifth sandwich.
Yeah. But yeah, that's not, as we're going to learn, that's not really Warren's personality. He's
very, very different. I mean, and that's one of the cool things about this being on the show and reading these, is that we're going to get to see the evolution of the characters.
Yeah, it's something I'm excited about.
And see where the changes happen, and see where even when we get to issue like 59, it's still going to be a world away from the same character after Giant Size X-Men number one.
Except for Cyclops, sadly.
Yeah, he's got that stick firmly implanted in his rectum pretty much from this issue, though he is Slim Summers.
They never mentioned Scott.
Nope.
That won't happen till issue 3, I believe, but don't quote me on that. But one thing about Stan Lee's writing, and I don't know if this is a criticism or just an observation, take it as either. I forgot how heavy the lettering is, the dialogue is, with exclamation points. Is everybody angry or just really melodramatic?
That's the Silver Age, though. If you look at DC, if you look at Marvel, everyone's talking like this! How are you doing today? I'm doing fine! Choke! Sob!
Like Steve Carell and Anchorman, loud noises!
I've never seen Anchorman, so I'll take your word for
that. Oh, no.
So, not a big Will Ferrell fan.
Okay. So. Well, page 3, for a book that's going to end up being on the back of tolerance and really try to be a message of that, Angel saying mistakes are for Homo sapiens, sir, is a little ironic.
Yeah, that is a little weird. It's like it's almost like he's overcompensating, one would say.
Yeah. And then we mentioned, you know, all the contraptions, Angel almost getting singed, smacked, flowing through what is essentially a ceiling fan on the floor, before the Professor X just throws one last just concussion sound. I don't know what that is, but as I mentioned, I think that's more like something out of episode 2 when Jango Fett fires the guitar, whatever that, I don't even know what you would call that. Since sound can't travel in space.
Sonic charges,
yeah. But yeah, the him fluttering, that's phenomenal, because it actually shows he doesn't fly like a bird who has to have a straight shot. He is able to actually hover to some extent. Or at least in the early days.
It's a great image, it really is. It would be even cooler if those were like metal and could shoot razor blades.
That would be a great idea. We should pitch that.
Yeah. We'll contact Bob Harris over at DC Comics.
And it just dawned on me, Beast throws a bowling ball, which apparently comes out of the locker, so they must be in some sort of gymnasium. There's a bowling alley in that mansion somewhere.
That's awesome.
And Iceman making his first ice construct, that is highly intelligent, and it shows, I mean, Bobby is 16.
Mm-hmm.
The kid actually has good resources, and of course he has that sense of humor, which is, Bobby actually doesn't change that much. He always has a sense of humor with a more quiet, nougaty center. But the genius of him making that ice contraption is pretty impressive.
Yeah, but he's also pretty much of the original cast, the most boring character for some reason to me. Yeah.
Not my favorite X. Well, actually, he was the first X-Man I knew from Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends.
Yeah, but even in that show, he was kind of, you know, Frank Welker's voice aside, kind of boring, though it's really interesting that he and Fred from Scooby-Doo share the same voice.
Yeah, that's... So. And as you mentioned on page 6, the image of Cyclops' visor, that not only does it show the raw power... For many, many years, I wondered how the visor worked, and later on, they kind of explained that there's some sort of trigger in his glove.
Mm-hmm.
But here, it was actually technology at the time. He actually had to flip the thing open.
Yes, and it basically he got to decide how far it opened is how much power was shooting out of it.
And that, I don't know why I like that, but I do, because I guess because I'm so nitpicky, having that mechanism explained kind of comforts me somehow.
I love that shot of Beast embedded in the wall.
I was going to mention that,
too. On the bottom of that page.
Hey!
Turn down that blasted visor of yours, will ya? You almost knocked me through, clean through the wall like those guys from Yancey Street.
It's clobbering time. Oh, wait.
Yeah, exactly.
But as I mentioned them wrestling, I'm not going to comment too much on that. I think it comments for himself, but... Jean walking in and the boys basically fawning over her. I think, and I'm glad you actually pointed this out, because it actually changed my perception of that a little bit, that it is, it had been a meat market for some time.
Yes.
So I would assume, and I'm just going to put this out here, Jean Grey is one of my all-time comic book crushes.
Okay.
I'm just, so it's hard for me to be biased with her, except for the whole dying thing. over and over again, which may allegedly happen down the road.
But maybe.
We can edit that out. But it's hard for me to be biased with Jean Grey. Man, but Jack Kirby, I mean, you did point it out. She does wear the pretty particular Marvel uniform. But he draws some gorgeous women for all the rough men, the blocky style that he has. He can do some great curves. Mm-hmm. Or could.
Now, his women, the hair was always off.
A little. It was about a decade early.
But no, his women were definitely curvy and feminine, so and can't argue with that.
And they can stand up for themselves as Jean throws Hank right up in the wall. Or into the ceiling. Was I too rough on him? Professor X is so blasé. Oh, let him walk it off.
Well, she's kind of blasé about it, too. She sits down, her hands are together. So, where were we? Professor.
Continue. And as awesome as Magneto is, he's one of my favorite all-time villains. And here, he looks great. What he's doing doesn't make sense at first. It took me another reread to actually understand, okay, makes sense. He's circumventing everything. There are missiles in Cape Citadel.
Mm-hmm. Cape Citadel.
But I think the fact that even though it was an action-packed issue, Magneto getting defeated in under 15 minutes still doesn't quite stick right with me.
The only way I could really explain that is that he was not expecting such a formidable adversary. So they managed to overwhelm him.
Okay,
simply because by surprising him.
Well, that would make sense for when he, I mean, you mentioned he sticks around, and I don't think it's a secret that when he comes back, it's a different story.
Yeah. Very, very different.
But you mentioned the missile launching sequence on page 14. I love sequences like that where you can actually see the physics and sort of grounds it in reality. But that, I mean, that was definitely a big note of mine. But Magneto just marching right up to the gate, that is actually very much in character, because Magneto is a cocky bastard.
Yes, he is.
And he never loses that. So, of course, he would walk right up and say, "This is mine."
Mine. Like, this is mine.
Yeah, like a cat peeing on things. Like that, too.
Dibs.
But I don't know how I feel about the effect used for the magnetism. And especially looking at page 15, the net.
Yeah, but at the same time, as sophisticated as Kirby was, there was only so much you could do on the printed page coloring-wise. So you had to kind of deal with what you had, you know?
Well, that's actually, I had a comment. It's actually, I didn't write it down, but it was a thought that occurred to me that, I mean, we're looking at page 16. This will, because it actually segues perfectly. You actually see the blue in the uniform.
Mm-hmm.
It's black most of the rest of the issue.
And I prefer black.
I do, I will admit it. And the action figures that Toy Biz made, the collector set, they were actually in black. But it made me realize, I forgot that at this time, there were literally four colors to work with that are mixed in different shades.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, as would be the late 80s, was pretty much there was a fifth color at that point, and then in the early 90s, pretty much everything went digital. It's a different beast now. You can do whatever you want color-wise.
Uh-huh.
But coloring in the 60s, especially in the Golden Age, was and I'm not slamming current colorists, but it was a different kind of art form. You literally dip the pen in the ink well, mix the colors. It was very much like a painting.
Yeah, coloring is something I've never quite understood completely, in all honesty. That may sound odd, and I have a good friend who tried to become a professional colorist in the 80s, but I'm not exactly sure what the colorist does and how that gets transferred to the film, basically, for them to print it into magazine form. It always kind of struck me as there's a step there that I'm just not understanding.
Yeah, and I never understood that, too. I know with the digital, I mean, well, they don't use the film anymore, really. It's a different creature altogether.
And I remember when they started playing with that in the 90s, there's a book called Justice League, A Midsummer's Nightmare, and they actually digitally blurred out a character's face, and I remember that looking so weird at the time, and now it's like Tuesday.
Yeah, it's commonplace now.
So, Marvel has in the past, and is continuing to do so, digitally recoloring old stories like this with modern coloring techniques. The one that I read was the first meeting between Ant-Man and the Wasp. And I gotta tell you, the Kirby artwork with the modern coloring looks great.
Really?
Looks good.
I can imagine that, because that's going to bring out his line work.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Though a lot of people can do that, like, at home right now with Photoshop.
Yeah.
Still.
Well, on page 17, you mentioned them going from a car to a jet. They're in a Rolls Royce.
Uh-huh.
How many super teams travel around in a Rolls Royce?
Yeah, those things were put together by hand.
Yeah. The Professor X is loaded. I don't know if we've caught that yet, but...
Yeah, he's a little rich. It's kind of the opposite of the Fantastic Four, who are constantly scrounging for money.
Yeah. So I kind of share your note about Cyclops just showing up and saying, oh, we'll handle this, but I kind of understand at that point the military is at the end of their rope. And it's kind of, yeah, why not send these freaks in? Why not? Better you than me.
Definitely.
And part of me almost wishes that we could have started the issue with this sequence that follows on page 18, where it introduces Iceman runs through, Angel flies over, Beast bounds somebody, Marvel Girl moves people out of the way, and then flash back. That would have been not that the beginning of this is bad, but this was a really good addition.
Yeah, but I'm kind of glad that it built to that. Instead of having that as the first thing you see. Like, you see a really good action scene first off, and then you see an even better action scene later on in the book. I don't know if that was the thought process, but I'm just trying to earn a no prize here. So for me.
But the sequence with the missiles, when I was rereading this, it immediately came to mind that this was like a Michael Bay movie.
Yes.
Not in a bad way, in the good essence of Michael Bay movies. It was a straight up
in the fun sense.
In the what?
In the fun sense.
Yeah. It was a popcorn movie all wrapped up in a comic book. And I love Angel dodging it. The ice grenades. Okay, Bobby probably wouldn't be able to hit it, but I'll let it go just for the sake of story. And I think my favorite panel in this whole book is actually on page 21, where Cyclops is blasting the cocoon off of Warren.
Mm-hmm.
The coloring on that, I don't know if it comes through on the reprints, just the crimson coloring and Cyclops pose is straight Silver Age. And I don't know why it hits me, but it's page 22, I'm sorry. First panel.
Oh yeah, the reprinting is great. It's like white and red. It's kind of interesting. The power is really evident. That's
well, it's a much better contrast to a few pages earlier when
actually
Cyclops...
No, it looks like crap in the reprint. It looks really cool on this page.
Okay, but it's a nice contrast to page 19 when Cyclops' whole head seems to be firing. It makes me think of when the first X-Men movie came out and the action figures were released. And I actually got the Cyclops action figure, which had the light-up action. But it was poorly made. So basically, instead of his visor lighting up, his whole face lit up. So he basically had Cyclops with sunburn action. It was just nice. I was so mad at myself for even purchasing it after that.
Oh, be easier on yourself. Also on that page 22, you see how the thing Magneto is hiding behind on the top is yellow, and the reprint, it's brown. He looks better against the yellow.
I agree. I mean, so. His colors would stand out much better against yellow. His scarlet colors. But yeah, I'm kind of, I love the tunneling and popping up and surprising him. That shows that they do have ingenuity. And then, kind of like you, I just think the issue just abruptly ended with Professor X's floating head in the sky. And I didn't need that image. That last image I could have done without.
Yeah, but I think this is why Magneto escapes, is that he thought he had him, and then they pop up at the ground. It's like, I can't kill these people. I've been trying for the past 13 and a half minutes, and it just hasn't worked.
Well, that makes sense, because Magneto would assume, with his ego, that he could take them out in, you know, a snap of a finger.
Mm-hmm.
And turns out this is somebody the type of thing he's never come up against. But overall, in this reread, I fell back in love with the X-Men again.
Yeah, I really, for the first time, I felt a real connection to the original class reading this issue, even though I know that they change a little. But I just felt something more for them than I had ever had before.
Yeah.
It was kind of strange, but they are the strangest superheroes of all, so that makes sense.
But yeah,
No, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go right ahead.
I can just see why Marvel kept taking a chance on these people and why they didn't let it completely go away when it was in reprints. Because it's a solid concept. You know, school of misfits fighting against evil versions of themselves, basically. I mean, look at all the TV shows that have popped up on, like, the Cartoon Network and other places where it's, you know, children sent off to a school, they all have powers, and they get into all kinds of hijinks. I mean, it all pretty much comes back to this.
So
superhero-wise.
Would you say Harry Potter would be a derivative of the X-Men?
No, because Harry Potter, from what I understand, because my wife and I spent a good bit of when the first Harry Potter film's coming out going, wow, they're doing a really bang-up job of ripping off the books of magic. But somebody from England wrote me an email and said, no, you got to understand is that the boys' preparatory school, like boarding school, is a real genre over there. And all she did was add magic to it. But apparently the concept of a young boy going away to school and finding himself is something that was kind of popular in English literature at one point.
So Gaiman and Rowling probably would have drawn from the same source.
Yes, exactly. And he goes, and if you look at young boys and the nerdy boys in England, they all have dark hair and glasses. It's nothing original. So
and scars and a lightning bolt scar, but
well,
So overall, man, this issue brought me back into the fold, and I'm already looking forward to issues to come.
Even though we have to deal with the Vanisher in 2 weeks.
Yeah, about that. I got lots of notes ready for that one.
Very good.
But elsewhere in the Marvel Universe, I just want to kind of cover the Marvel saga as that happens alongside the X-Men. So, for the book's cover dated September 1963, Thor, Ant-Man, Iron Man, the Wasp, and the Hulk assembled as the Avengers for the first time, sans Captain America, in Avengers number one.
And he would be retroactively a founding member.
Somehow, yeah. Just want to point that out as it happens. Iron Man rescued Pepper Potts and Happy Hogan from the icy clutches of Jack Frost in Tales of Suspense number 45. The Fantastic Four face Sub-Mariner in Fantastic Four Annual Number 1. Strange Tales Annual Number 2 ushered in the Marvel Age of Comics, as it stated on its cover, with a meeting of Spider-Man and the Fantastic Four's Human Torch. Now, I know we have the Avengers Number 1 over there, but I thought at this point there had been at least one other crossover. Am I incorrect?
Well, Spider-Man, I mean, the FF were an Amazing Spider-Man number one. So.
That's right. Thank you. That's the one I was thinking of.
And everyone showed up in Amazing Spider-Man Annual number one, too, but I don't think that's come out yet. No, that hasn't. I'm sorry. John Wilson is screaming at me right now.
Ant-Man fights the hypnotic effect of Trago's trumpet in Tales to Astonish number 47. And Journey into Mystery number 96 brings us a battle between the God of Thunder and Mad Merlin. And finally, Sandman makes his grand debut in Amazing Spider-Man number 4, which is in one of the ads in this issue.
Yes. That's a great issue, too. I actually kind of like that issue. He beats him with a vacuum cleaner.
I had an ex-girlfriend that hit me with a vacuum cleaner. It's not pleasant. I'm not talking like a dirt devil, a Hoover upright.
She beat me with a Dyson. That ball was covered in my blood.
But I think one of the great things about going back through a retro comic is the ads.
Oh, definitely. Like the creepy Mike Marvel.
Yeah, and his secret new Dynaflex method.
Can build you a magnificent new He-Man muscled body in just 10 minutes a day with absolutely no weights, no barbells, no exercise at all.
Just an extreme amount of pure raw crystal meth.
I'm the most amazing man ever. And it comes with free Secrets of Attracting Girls.
I want to know more about this Mike Marvel.
He is kind of creepy, isn't he?
Yeah.
I never understood the whole leopard print shorts thing. And I'm sorry if that's not a drawing and that's a photo, that guy's worked out with some weights. Either that or he's been doing some serious isometrics to just tone that body. And you could probably grate cheese on that thing. free with any purchase later in the issue, Lincoln Penny album.
Oh.
We pay up to $150 when it's filled with 150,000 pennies.
I was going
to
say.
4 Indian cents in an album. This is kind of, God, these ads suck.
Record your voice at home. Fun for the whole family.
10-day free trial before Pyramid Scheme A. Fuck. Completely folds under the weight of the crushing investigation. Curious coins, odd paper money. Catalog price 75 cents, but you're free to get names for our mailing list. So basically what they're saying is if you sell out some of your friends, you'll get a free catalog for their crappy money. Nice. Instant live sea animals at the bottom of that page. What is that? Brine shrimp? Yep. Exotic Saskatchewan brine shrimp. Ah, man, that really sucks. 10 king-size latex toys. You got Mickey Mouse, Dopey, Jiminy Cricket, Zorro. I guess this is when Zorro was still on television, too, and Davy Crockett. So this is really riding that Disney Davy Crockett Zorro kind of fad that was really popular in the 50s and early 60s. That makes sense. Reward, $11,750 for this coin. Why were they trying to rip so many kids off of money?
1804 silver dollar, 19,000 minted, only 12 accounted for.
Right. What? Didn't they put that into the World Trade Center? Or am I thinking of another? Or am I thinking of another coin?
No, there's another coin. Yeah.
Grog grows own tail, plant tail outside of it, and it grows like mad into a beautiful shade tree.
So it's essentially an early precursor to the chia, except in dinosaur form. I kind of want a grog.
You want a grog?
Yeah.
I'm sure he's nice. I'm sure he fetches things. But at the bottom of that.
Grant.
The oldest. You know, it's really funny. I used to make fun of these ads, but my friend Scott Gardner pointed out that at one point the newspaper that you sell for grit actually carried like the Star Wars comic strip for a while. So there was actually a reason to get grit outside of the bag of money that he's holding. Win free prizes like a hatchet.
Yeah, I was going to say a hatchet.
Swiss Army knife.
Yeah.
I can't tell what the rest of those are. This comic is so degraded. I love that full-page ad for Amazing Spider-Man number 4, though.
Yeah, I like that the covers, at least at this time, they were a lot more expressive. They told a little story in themselves from time to time. And that's one of the best versions of it. Even though Sandman's one of my, not my least favorite, he's not one of my favorite villains.
I'll agree with that, but I like him better than certain other classic Spidey foes. Like, I can't stand Mysterio.
I don't mind Mysterio so much. I'm not a big fan of the Lizard.
The Lizard serves a function. When a writer understands the Lizard, like a perfect example is the Spectacular Spider-Man animated series, where I thought they really got the Lizard, as opposed to that MTV video game cutscene animation cartoon of Spider-Man, where the Lizard was voiced by, what's his name?
Rob Zombie.
So, yeah.
Video cutscene. I actually liked that cartoon.
I wasn't a fan. I saw the first three episodes, and I just didn't like it at all.
It was NPH.
Well, yeah, I mean, the voice acting was great, but I just didn't like the animation. And the villains were kind of eh. So
it got better in the second half of the season.
I felt the same way about Birds of Prey. We got, speaking of Birds of Prey, we have a hodgepodge page of ads.
I was going to say.
Poems Wanted, 103 Different British Empire. From Britain's far-flung colonies, genuine catalog. Doesn't really even tell you what it sells.
It's a catalog of catalogs, Michael. Oh, don't forget the personal radio and to learn to play guitar in 7 days or get your money back.
Song ideas needed. 225 stamps for only 10 cents. This mammoth value includes stamps worth up to 25 cents.
Look, giant Philippine stamp plus New Zealand, Cuba, and others, only 5 cents. Why would you want a Filipino stamp?
Well, maybe we just don't understand the mind of the stamp collector.
Okay.
Though after the last page, first the Fantastic Four, and now in the same inimitable style by the same writer and artist, another group of fabulous characters, Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos. I've always meant to read these.
Same here, because most of my Nick Fury comes from the later, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Mm-hmm. I just want to see what a 60s war comic by Marvel is like. But it's got, I almost called him Dan Turpin. It's got Dum Dum Dugan on the cover.
Dan Turpin, wow. That's what is a Jack Kirby?
That's what I'm saying. Another really creepy ad. Give me just one evening and I'll teach you how to hypnotize easily.
They're called roofies.
I was saying, they got the guy hypnotizing the woman on the couch. I don't want to see the after picture of that before, basically.
Who's the guy pointing on the other side of the page?
I don't know, but check here. Hypnotic powers you want. Influence others. Self-hypnosis. Cure bad habits. Lose weight. Stop smoking. Perform stunts and tricks. Do mind reading. Gain magnetic personality. Relieve tension. And my all-time favorite, make money.
How do you hypnotize yourself to... Well, I guess you could launder money, but... Or, I've just completely lost my train of thought. Never mind.
And proving once again, and this still continues through the 70s, that comic publishers thought that their readership base was little kids and some illiterate adults. Amazing new home training plan and auto repairing.
Well, that was a relatively new technology at that point. I mean, not that the automobile was new, but the trade wouldn't have been that old.
The point is that there's always something like this in a comic book for the person that didn't finish high school and wants a career. It's like, I've seen others that are like repair televisions, repair washing machines, repair refrigerators. kind of like the old Big Rig ads. 100 toy soldiers for 25 cents. Those things are pieces of crap. And boys, girls, men, and women, if you know just 20 people, you could make at least $50, more likely $100 to $200 in your spare time, because everyone you know needs Christmas cards.
Except for my Jewish friends.
And everyone loves Wallace Brown cards, so that's... Marvel really didn't have the cream of the crop as far as advertising dollars.
No, they really
didn't.
In the
60s, did they?
But the money was green.
I'm sure it was. I'm sure they took all comers. So... Well, that was an amazing first issue. It really was.
It was. And well, as far as the historical occurrences, since we're looking back so far, there are some... It's going to be interesting to watch history unfold alongside this. For example, in July 1963, when this book hit, zip codes were introduced on July 1st. On July 5th, diplomatic relations between the Israeli and the Japanese governments are actually raised to embassy level. That's a start.
Yes.
And the Roman Catholic Church accepts cremation as a funeral practice. I didn't know that was ever an issue.
It doesn't surprise me that it does. I mean, we're talking right around the time period where they have Vatican II and decide that you can have masses in languages other than Latin. So
that's, yeah. And of course, I forgot who was president at this time.
So,
Well, July 12th, Pauline Reed, age 16, is actually abducted by Myra Hindley and Ian Bradley in Manchester, England, which begins what's known as the Moors murders. It was a pretty gruesome set of killings. So there's a cheerful bit of news. And July 19th, American test pilot Joe Walker, flying the X-15, reaches an altitude of 65.8 miles, making it suborbital, as recognized by international standards. I didn't know there were international standards for suborbital either.
Doesn't surprise me that there are. I mean, you have to have a system of measurement by which to measure what you're doing, so...
That's true. You and your logic.
Yeah, I'm kind of silly at 2:30 in the morning.
And on July 26th, an earthquake in Yugoslavia leaves 1,800 dead. Same day, NASA launches SINCOM, the world's first geostationary or synchronous satellite. I don't think those two are related.
Too. Yeah. No, seriously. Well, no. Or were they?
And Skynet went active that day.
The primitive form of Skynet, which really doesn't do all that much, and the Terminators are kind of ineffectual, but...
It's all steampunk, and...
I'm sure somebody's done steampunk Terminators.
Oh, I bet you could Google it. I'm not going to, but I bet you could.
As across the nation, hundreds of people listening to this episode are Googling it as we speak.
But I guess that pretty much brings us to a close this week.
Yes, sir.
It's a great first issue. Next time around, we'll be doing issue number 2. And if you have comments or anything, you can also hit us up. You can email us at xavierspodcast@gmail.com, or find us at Facebook. Just search us out at Xavier's Podcast for Gifted Youngsters. And any final thoughts this week?
I'm really not looking forward to The Vanisher.
Yep, I pretty much agree. Well, that wraps us up. We will see you in 2 weeks. As far as this episode, enough said.
Bye, everybody.
X-Men have won, but only for now. Magneto is still out there, waiting, planning, plotting the destruction of the human race. But whatever the challenge, whatever the peril, the X-Men will be there.